For the week of November 29th, 2015, this is Showbiz Sandbox, episode 302, the podcast that brings you all the dirt on the news making headlines around the entertainment world. In Los Angeles, I'm Jay Sperling Reich.
And in New York, back from Nashville, Tennessee, feeling healthy and spry, I'm Michael Gills.
Hello, Michael, from the other side.
Are you going to start coughing yet? Tell people you were sick.
Yes, I was sick. Okay, so I was traveling for a week on business, and then I came back and caught, I have not been that sick, and I'm still getting over it, but I was deathly ill for the Thanksgiving week.
Very unpleasant.
And the worst part was I really wanted to try and do a show for Tony K2342.
Oh, I love Tony K2342.
But not more, not more than I. He is my new favorite person. He or she, could be a she. This is a person.
Probably a he.
Probably a he, but you never know.
It's with a Y.
Right. This is a person who the latest five-star review on iTunes, the U.S. version of iTunes, as I now know, he writes, "That Sperling character, ... is hilarious. Seriously, I look forward to this podcast each week and yell at my iPhone when they take a week off. So sorry you had to yell at your iPhone, Tony K2342, but I was sick last week." He goes on to say, "If you are looking for insight into the entertainment industry, this is the place to go. Keep up the great work, guys, and we're going to try and do that this week."
Oh, well, guys, I think that includes me, too. So he kind of mentioned me, too. He mentioned you by name and me implied.
Yes. And while I was traveling in Brazil, actually, somebody came up and said they loved the show and that they had rate and reviewed the show in iTunes. And I said, really, we didn't see any Portuguese reviews. And apparently, when you rate and review the show on a specific country's iTunes, it stays in that country. So
it's kind of like Amazon.co.uk. The reviews for books there do not immediately pop up in America.
Right. So if you have reviewed the show, or you know what, just take some screenshots. Send us some screenshots of reviews of Showbiz Sandbox in iTunes stores throughout the world. We'd love to read them. Although my pronunciation of some languages is suspect.
Well, right. So, but we can translate it. But so, yeah, if you've reviewed the show in Australia or the UK or Korea or Brazil or anywhere, please do, call up iTunes because we didn't believe it that you had actually done a review. We'd love to see them. Send us a screenshot and we'd love to check it out. Where do they email those screenshots to, Sperling?
Dirt@showbizsandbox.com. That's DIRT@showbizsandbox.com. I'd say you could call and leave us a voicemail with them, but that probably doesn't translate so well. However, if you would like to call and leave us a voicemail, the number is 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Of course, you can subscribe to our show in iTunes, Stitcher, the Microsoft Marketplace, anywhere they give podcasts away for free. We're on Facebook. Just search for Showbiz Sandbox, and you can like our page there, as Raul Buril did. He suggested a story to cover, which we'll be getting to. And we're on Twitter. @ShowbizSandbox is our handle.
That's right. You know, and Tony K, we're like kind of friends, so I call him 2342. Tell me what 2342 can listen to on the show this week.
Well, on this week's show, we're going to catch up on sending out our sympathies for the great city of Paris, some Thanksgiving recipes, Black Friday horror stories, and of course, some entertainment news. People shopped and ate and apparently went to the movies over Thanksgiving here in the U.S., since a lot of films have good stories to tell at the box office, from holdover franchises like Hunger Games and James Bond to the latest Pixar film and even Sylvester Stallone, who is getting Oscar talk for Creed. We're always keeping an eye on the book industry. Some new reports on sales paint a dire picture for the ebook format and mid-sized publishers. We'll go over the numbers and get Michael to spell out the real story. During Inside Baseball, we'll tune in to some TV news. As I just mentioned, Fox became the first major network to say it is abandoning the practice of touting overnight numbers. It comes on the heels of a dawning realization by the industry that a sea change in viewing habits is here for real and will have a massive impact on TV viewing, TV production, TV promotion, and pretty much everything else. Of course, during Big Deal or Big Whoop, we'll cover all the big entertainment headlines from the past week. But first, as always, we turn it over to entertainment journalist extraordinaire Michael Giltz to fill us in on the weekend's box office.
That's right. And before we start, I've been waiting 3 weeks now, 2 weeks or something, to do a correction. We have a correction for the weekend of November 6th. We said the number one movie around the world was Spectre, the James Bond film with $190 million. Not even close. The number one movie around the world on the weekend of November 6th was, of course, Call of Duty Black Ops 3. That grossed $550 million over the weekend. That tops Jurassic World's worldwide gross of $524 million on opening weekend. It's an all-time record. So congrats to all the actors in the studio behind Call of Duty Black Ops 3.
Well, wait a second. Isn't Call of Duty a video game?
Whatever. What's the difference?
Well, because video games cost $60 a pop.
That's right. But it's still a remarkable accomplishment. We missed it. I don't know why I didn't see a story on that, but I wanted to make sure we did a call out to video game, which is a huge industry, employs a lot of people. And frankly, more and more, they look like little mini movies. When you watch them, the visual quality is pretty stunning. My nephews and other kids that I spoke to, people who play video games, they're not thrilled with Call of Duty Black Ops 3. But I kind of feel like these days when you got a big franchise, they almost always get slagged when they first come out. And, you know, if you're playing on opening weekend, it takes a while where they add in extensions, they add improvements. It's almost like opening weekend is sort of a previews on Broadway. You know, the game that you play on opening day when it comes out is not the same game that you were going to play 3 months from now, because they really do tweak it, refine it, add stuff into it. So Call of Duty Black Ops 3, you know, in a couple months may be vastly improved. So we'll have to see where it ends up. But a huge, huge amount of money, $500 million. Pretty amazing.
Well, you know, a lot of people are saying that about Fallout 4, what you just said, which is this is a video game that was released recently, and it's obviously the fourth in a franchise. But they're saying, you know, geez, it just takes so long to play that after like 30 hours and you finally achieve the first goal, you're like wondering whether you should keep going or just give up on it and think like, you know what? This is going to take too long. And
that's our coverage of video games for two guys whose last big video game was probably Asteroids.
That is not true. It was Pac-Man.
All right. So let's look at the weekend box office. Of course, here in North America, we had a holiday. Thanksgiving was on Thursday. It's a good weekend for movies, but not a massive weekend for movies. It's not like a July 4th or right around, you know, it's a weekend where movies get released, but they don't set records usually. So it is a very strong week for going to the movies, but not a massive one. So you won't see big all-time records popping up on Thanksgiving because people obviously eat turkey, they go shopping, blah, blah, blah. But we're looking at the worldwide totals for the weekend. And so it's only when we get to the total box office that we'll start including Wednesday and Thursday numbers as well. So this is the three-day weekend we're talking about around the world. So the number one movie around the world this weekend is The Hunger Games: Mockingjay Part 2. I actually saw it. Of course, it's not very good, but it grossed $113 million around the world. It's at $440 million and counting. Financially, it seems perfectly clear that they've added about $400 million or more to what they would have grossed if they just made the final movie, the final book, as just one movie. The final book probably would have grossed $1 billion. Add these two movies together, and you're looking at more like $1.4 billion. So it's worth the extra $250 million.
But artistically, is it worth it?
Well, you know, that's
not
a question, because also you're talking about its value as a library item and a value for people to purchase it and watch it and stream it 5 years, 10 years down the road. They're claiming they want to launch, you know, parks, theme parks. And in that case, I don't think it is worth it. I think it's a short term punch, but long term, you know, you make the last book two movies and it's not artistically satisfying, then it makes a less satisfying trilogy. Who wants to buy all four movies? Who wants to have them on their shelf? Who wants to go to the theme park? You know, they're not going to rewatch them as much. And so they're already talking about a prequel, like maybe doing the first Hunger Games as a movie. Well, are people as excited by that idea now? No, they're not. I mean, part of the fatigue is Divergent and Maze Runner and all the other movies that came in its wake. But I think artistically and commercially, the best long-term bet is to make the best possible movies you can, and that certainly doesn't usually include splitting them up into two flicks.
You know, it just dawned on me as you were talking there that...
And talking.
Well, Divergent and...
Maze Runner
and Hunger Games. I wonder if this is a commentary, because these are all young adult novels, but I wonder if it's a commentary on modern day, like, what are we leaving for our children? You know, we're just leaving them to fend for themselves. We're leaving them this horrible world where they're going to have to fight each other to survive.
It's a fad. You know, sure, there have been the Lord of the Flies, and there's always these things, and a little bit of it reflects reality. But I read a lot of young adult novels, and they come in waves. There were vampires, and there were dystopian, and now we moved on from dystopian books. A good one will always break through, but there aren't 57 of them every week. But there are movies every week, and the number two movie around the world is The Good Dinosaur. It's the second Pixar film of the year, the first time they've done that. It grossed $67 million over the weekend. It's at $84 million worldwide. It skews a little longer. It skews a little younger. It didn't get the great reviews of Inside Out, but it's gotten good reviews and audiences like it. And clearly parents dropped off their kids on Friday while they went shopping. That gave the kids something to do for 2 hours, 2.5 hours. And we'll have to see where it ends up.
Well, I think it's going to end up with a sequel, The Bad Dinosaur.
So you didn't see it, I take it.
I did not see it.
You're sick as a dog. Your kids didn't go without you.
They did not.
They did not. Well, and thank you, China, because The Martian is at number 3. It opened up in China. It grossed $54 million over the weekend. It's now at $545 million worldwide. It's the biggest movie of all time for director Ridley Scott, for actor Matt Damon, and it's still not done. It looks like it could get to 650 before all is said and done.
And think about it. This is Matt Damon, okay, a guy who has starred in the Bourne movies. And Ridley Scott, a guy who directed Gladiator.
And the Ocean's 11.
And the Ocean, you know. Yeah, I mean, so that's saying something that it's a bit, you know, his biggest movie. Now, I know somebody's going to say, how come I don't point out that inflation, tickets cost more now. But still, those movies weren't so long ago.
Well, and Gladiator is one, and it's about $100 million behind. It'll be $200 million behind, I think, before all is said and done. So I think this is going to be the winner for Scott, even taking into account the rate of inflation.
Speaking of winners and The Martian, did you hear that the Golden Globes, they're submitting The Martian as a comedy at the Golden Globes? And the Golden Globes said, yeah, okay, it's fine.
Well, it's the Golden Globes.
Yeah.
At number 4 is Spectre, which is also a comedy, right?
There are some funny moments in it, like when he gets the watch as a, you know, Q gives Bond a watch as his deadly weapon. And he says, well, what does it do? And Q says, it tells time. But really what it does is it makes us money for the commercial we're now doing.
It grossed $43 million over the weekend. It's at $750 million worldwide. This will be the second biggest Daniel Craig Bond film of all time. Only Skyfall will gross more. It's the second highest grossing Bond film overall of any star. So it's a massive success. But of course, if it doesn't gross exactly as much as Skyfall, people will say it's a failure.
Well, especially when it costs $245 million to make.
Right. But now it's in the red. It's in the black, isn't it?
Yeah,
it's
definitely
tripled its
there.
Budget. It's still going strong, so it's made money. Everybody's happy.
Nobody lost money on it. Did you see the film?
I did. I thought it was fine. It was a Bond movie.
There's
a Bond woman. There's a Bond car. There's some humor, but it's not thuddingly obvious. There's, you know, evil villains. There's an evil villain lair. It blows up. It was everything I expected in a Bond film.
Spoiler alert. Hello.
And no spoils for Creed. This is the number 5 film around the world. It's the spinoff from Rocky, I guess you could say. It grossed $32 million over the weekend, $44 million worldwide and counting. A terrific opening here in North America. Great reviews. And we said there's Oscar talk for Stallone. He plays, of course, Rocky, and he's now the mentor for the son of Apollo Creed. It's from the director and star of Fruitvale Station, a very nice indie film. And it's a hit, no matter how you slice it. And when we say Oscar talk, we mean somebody somewhere wrote a story saying, hey, maybe Stallone will get an Oscar nomination. And now everybody else can write stories saying, hey, there's Oscar talk for Stallone. The only time it really matters is if somebody actually gives him an award. If he gets a nomination or he gets an award from any actual body, then you can start to take it seriously.
I've heard not only Oscar talk for his performance in Creed, and this is Sylvester Stallone I'm talking about. I've also heard that his performance needs subtitles.
Yeah, well, that's been often the case. And number 6 is our first non-Hollywood movie, in a way. It is Our Times. This is a Taiwanese high school romance, looking back on your first bittersweet romance. It's sort of a spin on a movie that came out like 4 years ago that was from the boys' perspective. This is not that same story, but it's from the girls' perspective, and it's directed by a woman, directed by TV producer Frankie Chen, making her directorial debut, and it's a big hit. $13 million over the weekend, $60 million and counting. Didn't get great reviews, but Frankie Chen is laughing all the way to the bank. At number 7.
In what currency, though?
Taiwan currency? I don't know.
Yeah, just checking.
At number 7 is our big flop of Thanksgiving. It is Victor Frankenstein. It stars James McAvoy and Daniel Radcliffe, two very good actors, and it was a flop. There's no way to put it. $12 million over the weekend, $27 million and counting. It only cost $40 million, but it got poisonous reviews. I doubt it will do that much better worldwide. We'll have to see where it ends up. Maybe they won't lose their shirts because it was a modest bet, but just not a good movie. At number 8 is the Peanuts movie, which is a good movie, according to all the critics and audiences. Another $10 million over the weekend. It's at $125 million worldwide. Now, it's made almost all that money in North America. And it's I think the peanuts is known. They're known around the world. They're not just a U.S. phenomenon, but it has to make up its money overseas. And certainly it's been launched well. It's grossed its budget in the U.S. We'll have to see how it does around the world now. It's mostly in the U.S. right now. I think
it's totally in the U.S. right now.
I thought there was a, why do I have an international total for peanuts? We must have gotten something wrong. I have $9 million international for peanuts. So it played somewhere briefly.
Yeah, I think you're right. I think it played in the U.K.
Right. So it's it has right now it's only in the U.S., but it did play out in the U.K. and it's got a lot of territories to go. We'll have to see how strong the Peanuts brand is worldwide. And number nine is another international film. It's Inside Men. This is a South Korean thriller about political corruption, and it's based on a webtoon. Do you know what a webtoon is?
It's a toon that is on the web.
That's exactly right. How did you do that? It's not a comic strip online. It has sort of motion and stuff, and they've gotten more and more sophisticated. So you might have panels fade out and fade up to the next panel. Sometimes they have zoom. Now they have a little sound effect. So it's not a movie. It's not an animated cartoon. It's not a comic strip or a graphic novel, but it's somewhere in between. And they've gotten a little more sophisticated. They're very popular overseas. I'm sure people here in the U.S. read them too. But this is a spinoff from one of the more popular ones. It grossed $9 million over the weekend. It's at $25 million and counting. And some of them have been translated into English, so I'll be checking some of them out.
Well, so it's kind of, these webtoons are kind of like a Ken Burns documentary.
At number 10 is Bridge of Spies, the Steven Spielberg film. It cost $40 million to make. It's made $100 million worldwide so far. It's in 45 territories. It made $8 million over the weekend. It's like a classic Spielberg film. It's chugging along. Will it have any nominations and Oscar talk down the road? Perhaps. We'll have to see what happens. It's a very crowded field. And by that, I mean there's no big front runners.
That's really what makes it a crowded field. You're right.
Yeah, I mean, there are no obvious films, I don't think, at all, really. There's, we could all name 10 or 15 movies that are in the running, but there's nothing that seems like a lock. I don't think Bridge of Spies is a lock. I don't think anything is a lock, particularly. I mean, I assume Carol will get nominated. I assume Brooklyn will get nominated. I assume there are bigger Hollywood movies that might, but I don't know of anything
We have yet to see Star Wars. We have yet to see The Revenant. Which is in your
Well, The Revenant is more likely. Star Wars often will certainly get technical nominations, right. And it has competed back in 1977. But since then, it's not really been a player in the Oscars, except for special effects and stuff like that.
Right.
All right. But yeah, The Revenant. I haven't read that book yet. I'm very excited. I'm going to read that before the movie comes out. I'm not a big Iñárritu fan, but somehow I'm really excited to see this movie. Hey, it's a Western. We got Tarantino coming out. Another two Westerns.
Yeah. That's right. We have...
There's lots of movies coming out. There's lots of movies already out that seem to be on the radar for Oscar type movies. But yeah, it's a pretty wide open year, which means we're more likely to see 10 films get nominated, right? The fewer dominated movies are, the more likely 8 or 9 or 10 films will get nominated the way they do the voting.
Yes, that is correct.
And number 11 is The Night Before. This is the Seth Rogen, Joseph Gordon-Levitt comedy. It grossed $8 million over the weekend. It's at $25 million and counting. That's just about what it cost to make. Did not have a great opening weekend. Did not have a great Thanksgiving. It is Christmas themed, so maybe it'll chug along. I like everybody involved in the movie. I wish it was doing better. I wanted Joseph Gordon-Levitt to get some love after
The Walk.
The Pain of the Walk, which is most certainly not in the Oscar talk anymore, except perhaps for some technical issues. I'd be stunned if it did anything come Oscar time. But, we'll have to see what happens with it. But, Anthony Mackie's in the movie, too. There's a lot of fun people in the movie. I'd kind of like to check it out. And yet I haven't gotten around to it. And that's why it's only grossed $25 million. And number 12 is The Vanished Murderer. This is it's a Hong Kong movie. It's a 30s noir. It's sort of an attempt to duplicate the success of The Bullet Vanishes, which was a big critical and commercial hit a few years ago. This doesn't seem to be quite as big a critical hit, but it grossed $6 million on its opening weekend. It's directed by Lo Chi-Leung, and we'll have to see how it does, but it's gotten off to a decent, okay start. And number 13 is a sequel in Spain to the biggest Spanish film of all time. It is Spanish Affair 2, which is a sequel, of course, to Spanish Affair 1, but those names have nothing to do with what the movies are called in Spain. In Spain, the original was called Eight Basque Surnames, and it became the second highest grossing film of all time in Spain, behind only Avatar.
Wow.
Now we have the sequel, Ocho Apellidos Catalanes, or Eight Catalan Names. So it's more romance and people from different regions of Spain. Big, big success. $5 million over the weekend, $17 million and counting. Finally, two more movies, a couple more movies. Another South Korean film, Bad Guys Always Die. It's a crime drama starring Chen Bo-lin, who I still like from, isn't it Blue Gate? What was that swimming movie called? But it's a South Korean-Chinese co-production. And that's why it's kind of interesting. There's a Chinese director, South Korean cast, and it's done in South Korean language. And it's set on an island in South Korea that is a very popular destination spot for people from China and South Korea. So it's a real co-production where they're trying to catch lightning in a bottle, but it got really bad reviews, and it made $4.7 million over the weekend. So did Hotel Transylvania 2, Adam Sandler. It's at $434 million. It's about $100 million past what the original made before all is said and done. It could get there. It's at $80 million right now, but I think it will get another $20 million. So it's definitely a solid sequel, and I'm sure there will be a Hotel Transylvania 3. Adam Sandler isn't done yet.
Well, yeah, and there's an example of a sequel that is actually outpacing its original, and you can thank DVDs and home video for that. You know, it did quite well on home video, where people saw the film and went, how come I didn't know when this movie was released? This is pretty good.
And it did well when it was originally released. It wasn't like Die Hard, where it was a modest hit and then the sequel blew up.
Right.
You know, the first one was a hit. But yeah, no, it definitely, when it's good, that's why Hunger Games. You want to do prequels? You want to have parks? Make a good movie. And there are some big indie films in the American top 10, or I should say North American. Speaking of Oscar, Spotlight, the Boston Globe investigation into the Catholic Church, Brooklyn, a nice film, Carol, The Danish Girl, they're all doing well at the North American box office. Some of them are very limited. Some of them have now expanded to like 500-600 screens, and they're all making a name for themselves and all proving to have durability with critics and audiences. We'll have to see where they end up.
I'll tell you, Spotlight is getting phenomenal word of mouth. I mean, I hear people in the streets actually talking up this movie.
Stop eavesdropping on people in the streets.
Well, they're at the Starbucks and, you know, they're waiting for their coffee and they're talking about the movie. So
I made fun of Star Wars because they mentioned advance ticket sales were huge, but
yes,
they didn't say what they were. And we finally have a number. Star Wars advance tickets as of like last week or whenever this story ran, the 19th of November. So that's 11 days ago. It had sold a record $50 million in advance tickets, which is double the previous record of $25 million for The Dark Knight Rises. Good God, that's a lot of money.
And of course, Disney is saying, please, it's not going to be a big opening, okay? Everybody, let's talk down this opening, because otherwise, it's never going to live up to the hype that you guys now have stoked.
So, that's right. They're like, if it doesn't gross $300 million on opening weekend, it'll be a disaster. And there's a New York Times article right now about how everybody in Wall Street had sort of focused more on TV and cable and all that big money, and they weren't sort of getting swayed by Hollywood. But now with Star Wars, they're all ignoring the bad news coming from, you know, TV and other stuff, because they just think Star Wars, Star Wars, Star Wars. They know the movie's going to make $1 billion. They know there's a movie coming every year for the next 20 years. They know there are theme park attractions coming up in like 5, 7, 8, 10 years. So they're focused on that as powering Disney. Phenomenally so. So it's all the more reason why they want to calm people down. Let's look at it. The December record for opening weekend is only $85 million. That's for one of the Hobbit films. I say only, it's a lot of money. But in December, there's a lot going on. People go every day to the movies, but they don't go necessarily all on the same day.
Yes, that is because they're busy traveling. They're going to relatives and friends for the holidays, and they'll go see it the first week of January or right before New Year's.
Well, let's say December 15th, 16th, 17th, 18th,
right.
19th, 20, you know. And you look back to the overall record, it's The Avengers in 2012 when it opened to $207 million domestically. That was a record. Capacity for that movie was at 63%.
Wow.
I point that out because that's interesting, isn't it?
Yes, because rarely do they talk about capacity.
Because that talks about the amount of capacity they can handle, right? I mean, $200 million, but like there were 37% of the seats weren't sold.
Yes.
And that's at every screening, of course, 11 a.m., 1 p.m., 3 p.m., 5, you know, all the way to midnight. But nonetheless, that's kind of interesting. You can see we've got the capability to easily go up to $300 million.
Now, when I was at Expo Cine in Sao Paulo in Brazil 2 weeks ago, every studio gave a presentation and Disney gave a presentation about their upcoming slate. And of course, they spent a lot of time on Star Wars. They asked for our cell phones before we entered the theater. And I thought, oh, great, we're going to see some new footage. And
sure. They didn't show anything?
They didn't show. I was like, oh, it's the trailer that's online that's been watched 500 million times. Oh, it's the kind of behind the scenes trailer that everybody's seen. Like, they showed nothing new. What they did do was go over, and this presentation was in Portuguese and it was in Spanish, but they went over the...
Both of which you're fluent in.
Well, I'll tell you this much. You don't realize how much Spanish you actually know until you realize how little Portuguese you truly know. they were going over all of the tie-ins and the marketing push, and they are marketing this thing so heavily in it with all these tie-ins. I mean, tie-ins you would never expect in countries you would never think that they would need a tie-in or some merchandising licensing deal. Disney is really going all out.
Well, they're going to make more money on the toys than they are on the movie, right?
Well, it's not the toys so much as they're trying to market the actual film itself. They have like C-3PO up the side of a building, you know, in Brazil. It was pretty interesting. And then they didn't show anything new. I was kind of, can you tell I was disappointed by that?
The only Portuguese I know is Fernando Pessoa, and I'm sure I just mispronounced his name, but he's a great Portuguese writer, and that's about it.
Oh, speaking of tie-ins and everything, you remember we said that Air France thing where you could like fly to France and see the film 2 days before, since it's opening 2 days? So apparently Air France did not have permission to use the Star Wars logo or actually get Disney's permission for any of it. So they had to actually kill the
ads.
Yes. So
did people who buy tickets get refunds, or are they still able to go?
They're still able to go. It's still a promotion. You can still spend the $1,500 to fly from New York or LA to Paris and see it there. But why would you do that without permission? I mean, it makes no sense.
Opening this week are two more movies: Krampus, a holiday horror comedy. I guess it's sort of a Gremlins type feel, though I think it's a little darker than that, but I'm not sure. And Spike Lee's Chi-Raq, which, frankly, that's from Amazon. And we talk about Oscars and Netflix and Beast of No Nation and how will this influence them. Can Amazon launch an Oscar-nominated movie? It's getting great reviews. It's getting his best reviews in many a year. The trailer's a lot of fun. I'm actually really looking forward to checking it out.
How odd would that be for Netflix if Chi-Raq winds up getting nominated for Academy Awards and Beast of No Nation gets overlooked?
Why would it be odd?
Well, because Netflix spent all this money and all this effort and all this energy to like really put themselves into the Oscar race. And here comes Amazon going, oh, yeah, we have this movie from Spike Lee. Here you go.
What do you mean? No, it's not a, you make it sound like this indifferent low. Well, whatever. It's, what do you mean? They backed Spike Lee and made a movie. He's a major director.
Yeah, but I mean, the awards push behind that.
That's like saying Paramount is annoyed that Disney got an Oscar nomination. Yeah. I don't know. It's like Netflix gets tons of Emmy love. You know, they'll get Oscar love someday. It won't be weird at all. It'll prove that what they're doing has value and can work on an Oscar level.
Well, do you think that a film that opens streaming should...
No. We've had that discussion.
Okay, so let's not get into that.
No, they have rules. It needs to play in a theater. It's perfectly appropriate, you know.
All right.
They're not in the TV business. They're not in the website business. They're in the movie theater business. So it's perfectly fine. They have rules. Will they change and adapt a little bit? Sure, but, you know, yeah.
Well, speaking of changing and adapting, I know that's what the book industry is doing, Michael.
Because they have no choice.
Yeah, they have no choice. And I know there's some numbers from Nielsen you want to talk about.
That's right. But it's important to point out that those stats from Nielsen that we're doing don't include information from Amazon. And of course, Amazon is the number one bookstore online and thus probably for the entire country. And of course, Amazon dominates ebooks and especially self-published titles. Nevertheless, here's the best snapshot we have of the North American publishing industry. Let's see what they have. Start us off, Sperling.
Well, I guess I'll give some figures. And Michael, why don't you tell us what that actually means? The big five and self-published titles, they seem to dominate, just as with the movies. Where only big blockbusters and indies thrive, the medium-sized publishers are kind of getting squeezed out.
That's exactly right. I mean, you see in movies that studios don't like to make the $40 to $80 million movie. They'll spend $10 million, they'll spend $110 million, but that middle one scares them, even though that's where some of the best movies often and usually come from. Same thing is happening, apparently, in the book industry. Tiny, small presses and medium-sized publishers are getting in trouble. Self-published people, they're doing good. They've got a big chunk of the market. And the big five, the biggest five publishers that we have, those are Hachette, HarperCollins, Macmillan, Penguin Random House, and Simon & Schuster. That's the big five. they dominate, and then the self-published people have a big chunk, and the guys in the middle are getting squeezed. It's harder and harder to be a publisher. You know, you can be a monster, you can be on your own, but to be in that middle ground where many and most publishers are is getting harder and harder.
So, you know, if you don't want to work with a publisher, you know, a medium-sized publisher or even a big publisher, don't worry, because self-published titles account for 18% of all book sales. And that's pretty remarkable, because that is one out of every six books sold is self-published.
But it's not, because what? That 18% is the 18% of the gross dollar amount. So that's the market share, not unit share. And self-published books are often a lot cheaper, often significantly. So you might have a lot of self-published books for $2, $3, $1, and compared to, you know, $9, $8, $15 for a an ebook from a publisher. So in fact, they're probably a much bigger chunk of unit sales that often gets lost in the picture. When you talk about market share, they're usually talking about the dollar value. And, you know, if you're buying 10 books from a guy and they're a dollar each, that's about equivalent to one book from a major publisher.
Well, so what I would point out is, again, a lot of those self-published titles get sold through Amazon, which we don't have numbers for.
And that's right. Yeah, this is 18% of the market that Amazon doesn't necessarily have, you know, that we're not necessarily counting Amazon on.
Well, now the big five, these are the big five you just mentioned, the Hachettes and the Random Houses, the HarperCollins, the Macmillans, the Penguins, the Simon & Schuster's, a lot of names there. Have you noticed that? A lot of last names.
Or at least five.
Yeah. 37% of the market is dominated by those big five publishers.
Right. So from these Nielsen figures, you see 55% of the market is self-published. I mean, you think about it, like, that's about 20% of the market. That is dollar amount is self-published. That didn't happen 10 years ago. You know, that just didn't exist. People self-published books, and it happened. You know, John Grisham self-published, I think, and went around selling it. You know, people would sell books and put them in beauty parlors and barbershops. I mean, people have self-published, and they end up being hits and get picked up by publishers. But it was never the level of success that it is now. 20% of the dollars sold are for self-published books. That's crazy. So you add them and the big five together, and looking at 55% of the market. And as far as the books sold, it's probably more like 65 or 70%. So the indies, the small people, they're really getting pushed out.
Well, Michael, I have to admit, you're going to have to catch me up here, because I was a little lost. I was writing down ideas for my new self-published book, and I forgot where we were. But, you know, wait, you know what? We were talking about books. Hold on. I'm just in my mind trying to remember. Ebooks. How about ebooks versus print? Because I know print, I think if it were up to me, print probably outpaces ebooks. In fact, I'm looking at these figures here. 74% of revenue comes from print, and ebooks come, I guess, make up 26%.
Right. So 25% of the whole market of the gross is ebook already. That's amazing when you think about all the categories where ebook just doesn't even work. You can get an ebook that's a picture book, but most people don't. There are art books, there are coffee table books, there are technical. There's tons of stuff that just isn't even done on ebook.
Think
doesn't
about it
make
this
any
way.
Sense.
I'm going to say one word, although it's comprised of two words. It's a compound word: cookbooks.
Well, and they should work great on ebook. And I know people who scan their cookbooks and make them PDFs and put them on their tablet. And that works really great, because they travel a lot and they want to have their cookbooks with them. That's what they do. And you think about it, you want a cookbook in the kitchen that can't get wet or blah, blah, blah. Their cookbooks are bulky. You know, video would be helpful sometimes. So I know that there are innovations in cookbooks, and that's happening. But still, they're great gifts. People love to hand them out. They have lovely pictures. And so cookbooks still are really, really dominated by print. So who is buying ebooks and what? It's text. You know, books like mystery, sci-fi, romance, literature. Those are all still monster categories for ebooks, and that's where ebooks really dominate. So those categories where ebooks are players are categories where they're obviously a lot bigger than 26%. And again, that 26% is revenue. So you know you're looking at probably a dominating portion of mystery, sci-fi, romance, and maybe even fiction are sold as ebooks already today. So when people say, "Oh, ebook sales are they're sliding down, they're dead," whatever. At worst, ebooks are like half the unit sales for fiction, for text-based books, probably half of the sales. When you look at where they might be in the future, they should grow, or they will grow. But at the very least, you can see that they're already a significant player.
So let me ask, are these ebook sales, is this the reason that some of these publishers are announcing lower earnings because ebook sales are dropping?
Right. Well, they're not dropping. Mostly they're slowing. So okay. ebook sales are not growing at the galloping pace that they were
at first.
Well,
I mean, when you think about it, it's just like DVDs. It's like you had everything on VHS, you kind of replaced it with DVDs, and then you kind of got bored and you stopped doing that. And you're certainly not going to do it with Blu-ray, since it's the same concept.
Well, no, most people did not buy new books on ebook that they already owned a hardcover or paperback of.
Oh, okay.
But as when you have new adopters, yes, they said, oh, I've got an ebook, and they fill it up and they buy stuff because they're all excited. And then, of course, they've got 20 books on their Kindle or their e-reader, I should say, and then they're not that eager to buy more because they've got to work through the books they just bought in a flurry of excitement. But yeah, ebook sales are slowing and people think that's permanent and this is it. I think it's a pause. Though there are lots of reasons why it might not work out. And publishers had bad quarters, and they all blamed ebook sales. Ah, ebooks are slowing up. It's that damn ebook.
Yeah, but wait a second. Didn't they have the agency deal thing with Amazon, and then now they get to call the price? And
exactly. If you go look at all those deals that they had to make with the government, have now expired. So now publishers are free to set ebook prices again in certain ways, you know, following the law. And so now when they were sort of prevented from doing it, now they can raise ebook prices again because they're always angry with Amazon about having low ebook prices. And yeah, when you put out a hardcover for $25, having the ebook for $10, guess what? You know, the hardcover may be on sale for $16, but when you could go to Amazon and buy the ebook for $10, you bought that, you know, every time, right? Well, now you go back to Amazon and now you can see lots of ebooks cost more than the on sale price for the hardcover. They cost more than the paperback, which is crazy. So in the last few months, all the big publishers, for all their big new titles, you can see across the board practically, they've jacked up ebook prices. They've jacked them up sometimes more than hardcover and print. And they go, oh my God, I don't understand. Why are ebook sales slowing down? Because you just made them more expensive. They're less useful than a hardcover or a paperback. You can't sell them. You can't give them away. You can't loan them. You can't put them on your shelf. And yet, they're now cost more money.
Well, you know, Here's something that's interesting to me about books. So I went into Barnes & Noble, which is down the street from me. And you know that book, Michael, City on Fire?
Mm-hmm, yeah.
Garth.
900 pages.
It's a big, big title this fall.
Ebook. Who the hell would want to read that in hardcover?
The reason you might want to read that in hardcover is there's some pages that are actually, like, you know, handwritten, etc. It's all over the front of the store. And I kind of made a comment to myself, really, saying, oh, my God, somebody's really pushing this book pretty hard. And
it's Rick Hallberg, by the way.
Yeah, Garth Rick Hallberg. Yeah. And literally the store manager behind me said, you're absolutely right. Whoever published this book, they really wanted to sell because we had been told to put it anywhere and everywhere up front. And so
they paid for it. That's an ad, remember?
That's right.
That's an ad. So the publisher, which is Knopf, which is Penguin Random House, I believe. I hope I'm right about that. But Garth Risk Hallberg is the author, and the publisher, Knopf, paid money to have it on those front tables. They're handing over chunks of change to do that. That's not something that Barnes & Noble said, oh, I think I'll do this.
Well, but I wonder, I mean, you would think that why bother advertising in bookstores when nobody's going into them anymore, apparently.
Well, they do go in, and it's advertising. It's a billboard. People walk by the window and see the windows, or they walk in to get, you know, one thing and they see something for else, and then maybe eventually they turn around and buy it. The more you see it, the more impressions you have. Oh, that's a big book. And this is a case where they have not raised the ebook price foolishly. It's too much. The ebook price is $15 on Amazon, and the hardcover is on sale for $18. So the Kindle is a few dollars cheaper. And that's what you'll see. You'll see when the Kindle version or the ebook version, forgive me, is a few dollars cheaper, that's when people see it's worthwhile. So you get $3 or $4 or even more, then they really are happy to buy the ebook version despite its limitations. And in this case, it's a $900 book, so it just makes sense.
A $900 book? I'm not buying
it. It's a 900-page book.
Okay, because I was going to say down at the Barnes & Noble, maybe that's why all sales at bookstores are going up.
Well, that's right. According to the Census Bureau, bookstore sales leaped 6.7% in September compared to 1 year earlier. That was enough to bring the first 9 months of this year up a smidge over 2014 as well. So sales in September, $1.8 billion, and the year overall is doing better, or just about equal, really, to 2014. So good news for the book industry overall. Ebook sales have slowed, but that's what happens when you raise the price. And mid-sized publishers, which are a bulk of the publishers, the vast majority of publishers, all the people after the big five, they are hurting. And when there's all those mid-list authors that the big five have dumped, They go to midlist, they go to middle publishers and small presses and university presses, and those people are definitely feeling the squeeze.
Well, then maybe it was worth Knopf advertising City on Fire at Barnes & Noble.
Well, it's their big bet, you know. They spent a lot of money to pick up the book and they wanted to succeed, and you know, they're going to lay their money down to make it a big deal.
Oh, well, if Knopf is going to try and make City on Fire a big deal, then it must be time for Big Deal or Big Whoop, our weekly segment where we discuss the top headlines in entertainment and tell you whether they're really important or just overhyped nonsense. Our first story, that bastard son of a father of our country, his name is Alexander Hamilton, and he's got the biggest show on Broadway. Hamilton isn't just the most critically acclaimed show on Broadway, it's not just the hottest ticket, it's also the highest grossing show on Broadway. That's the big news here. A few weeks ago, it trumped The Lion King with $1.7 million in sales, a smidge more than the $1.7 million that The Lion King grossed, a 15-year-old show. It's like 20 years old. How old is that show? It's old. Hamilton has been going back and forth with the Book of Mormon for months, and now it passed that show and The Lion King and Wicked. Since then, Wicked and Lion King have rebounded, and their natural advantage in having more tickets to sell has them back on top, because of course those theaters that Mormon and Wicked and Lion King are in are bigger. But Hamilton is pretty much printing money. Big deal or big whoop?
Oh, it's a big deal that it topped the box office even briefly for 1 week. But you look at Book of Mormon, that show's been out for quite a while. That is still tearing it up too. I mean, that is a hot, hot ticket. It's still not available for house seats. It's still not discounting. And so you have to be impressed by how strong Book of Mormon is doing as well. You know, Hamilton, we've all guaranteed, it's going to be a big, huge, long-term hit. I'm sure it will be. We'll have to see what happens when Lin-Manuel steps out of the show. I don't think it will matter. But, you know, nobody else in the cast is a big name yet. They've all become big names among the cognoscenti. But, you know, it is a big hit any way you slice it. And I don't know about you, but people were listening to it over the Thanksgiving. Everybody I know, my friends, like the family I was with, they started playing the opposite. Oh, they were playing Book of Mormon, actually. Now that you mention it, they were playing this. And I said, why don't you listen to Hamilton? So they started playing. They all loved it. The kids loved it. The parents loved it.
Michael, they just wanted to be in the room where it happened. The room where it happened.
Right. So this is just a phenomenal hit. There's no way to slice it. Even with those few seats, they were able to top the charts ahead of The Lion King and Wicked. Now is a big time for theater. Everybody is going to theater now. Everybody in New York comes for shopping and for theater. They all want to see a Broadway show. I hope they bought their Hamilton tickets months ago.
Yeah, I was just going to say, there I made a joke that really only people who paid $500 a ticket could possibly get. And
well, no, but now Hamilton is going to tour the world.
They've already got
auditions open for replacement cast members, which won't happen until after the Tony Awards, I believe. You know, they're not going to put any of the lead actors will not leave until the Tony Awards and, you know, probably June or July of next year. But they've already got auditions up for national tours and for replacements. That's, you know, long term. But that show will tour the U.S. and the world. It will come to Brazil. It will come to Paris. It will come all over the world. It will come to Korea and Japan. You know, so it'll come all over the U.S. So people will see it. And you look at the advance for Star Wars. We knew that as of like a few weeks ago, it sold $50 million in tickets. Hamilton has a record $57 million in tickets. That's for a Broadway show. Obviously, the tickets are a lot more expensive, but that's still awfully impressive.
Nothing says a successful musical in Brazil than a hip-hop musical about a founding father of another country. Speaking of, speaking of Hamilton, did you see that they're going to pit Leslie Odom Jr., who plays Aaron Burr, against Lin-Manuel Miranda,
pitting them. They're both lead actors. I mean, they should both be up for lead actor. They're not pitting them like it's a competition. It's like they're both leads. Aaron Burr is certainly a lead role, so it should be. There's other actors like the guy playing Thomas Jefferson and Lafayette. That's arguably almost a lead as well. He was lucky to get into Best Supporting. Because, you know, he won't be right at them. But, you know, those two guys are the leads of the show. They should be up for Best Actor.
Well, maybe at some point there'll be big arguments over how much money was made on the show and who gets it, kind of like there is in Hollywood. We are shocked, in fact, shocked to find accounting games being played by Hollywood studios. The latest to get sued is, guess what? Fox. Barry Josephson, an executive producer on Bones, the longest-running hit drama in Fox history, is suing. The usual stuff is alleged. They forgot to include $20 million in overseas sales and money from Hulu. Oops. They reclassified digital sales as home video because the deal is better for the studio that way. The lawsuit refers to Hollywood accounting as, quote, so commonplace as to be cliche, end quote.
meaning shenanigans with it, I guess. Yeah. Or the idea of Hollywood accounting. Yeah.
I mean, every time we run across one of these stories, I think, oh, do we have to cover it? One new wrinkle here, though, is that Josephson says Fox lied to him, claiming others associated with the show agreed to a new lower fee in exchange for the show being renewed and fraudulently forced him to do the same. And that happened more than once. Big deal or big whoop.
Don't these people talk to each other?
You know what? Actually, here's the thing. Here's what's going on. Barry Josephson is the executive producer. He's one of the, you know, original producers of this show.
Right.
So he's probably not associated with it as much on a day-to-day basis anymore.
He's not the showrunner, as far as you know.
Well, no, he's definitely not.
Okay.
And so what winds up happening is that, you know, agents cut all of these deals with the networks. And
I still think I'd pick up a phone.
Yeah,
and go, what? You're saying everybody else agreed? I'd call up the other executive producers or the showrunner and say, hey, is that against the law? Can you not talk to them about deals that you're cutting with the studio? You know, well, your salary, the actors can talk to each other about their salaries.
Sometimes you can, very often you don't. And there are reasons for that, you know, personal
reasons.
I know
you don't, but you should.
And, you know, certainly if the studio or the network said, hey, everybody is doing X and there's proof of that, that's fraud.
Yeah.
So...
Especially when they weren't. Yeah, that's fascinating.
But here's a guy who's probably, you know, he probably has people himself, representatives himself, that are dealing with his contracts, and he's finding out about it, you know, now. So
yeah. So it's a big whoop until it goes to trial and we get to see some evidence.
Yeah, it's never going
to
happen.
Because unfortunately, it won't go to trial.
Yeah, no. So this is fascinating, Michael. For decades, the story of Anne Frank writing her diary while hiding in an attic in Amsterdam from the Nazis has inspired the world. I've been to the attic. I've climbed up the stairs.
Did you kiss a girl in the attic?
I did not, no. Why?
Okay. A little Fault in Our Stars reference. Keep going.
In the prologue of the novel, or the diary, her own father assured the world that this precocious work was indeed essentially the work of Anne Frank herself. They've always acknowledged editing it down for purposes of privacy and the such, but now, out of the blue, the Anne Frank Foundation is insisting that, in fact, her father was more involved and legally counts as co-author of the most famous diary in history since Samuel Pepys.
Peeps, I think.
Okay, I don't know who that is, actually.
Okay, keep going.
So what gives, Michael? You know what gives? Copyright. Since Anne died so tragically young, her book would have gone into the public domain in January. If her father is the legal co-author, it will remain under copyright and remain profitable for 70 years past Otto Frank's death, which was in 1980. And this is a quote, it's not about the money, end quote, officials of the foundation insisted.
And they're a nonprofit and they do donate money to things, but still.
Yeah, I mean, basically all their money goes to, you know, some, yeah, nonprofit charities. So, yeah, I would agree. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop. It's the 1,000th example of copyright reform so desperately needed.
Yes, and there's a second editor, Miriam Pressler, who is still alive. And she
Mirjam. I don't know how to say her name.
Mirjam. Yeah, I don't know how to pronounce her name. But thank you for pointing
out. They did a definitive edition in 1991 where they put back in some of the things that embarrassed the father about her period and sexual awakening. It's not scandalous stuff, but it was stuff that was not included because he's like, oh, I don't want to put that in for my daughter. And so they put that stuff in and created a revised definitive edition. That one's supposed to still be in copyright, huh?
Yeah. That's correct.
They claim that's still in copyright, so we'll have to see. But I mean, it's kind of symbolically important. In January, Mein Kampf enters the public domain. And now, in this case, Anne Frank's book would enter the public domain on the same month as sort of a counterbalance to that. It's sort of a nice, neat thing, and it's sad that this fracas is creating a cloud over that.
What do you think? Mein Kampf going into the public domain film adaptation?
Been done.
ESPN recently had a wave of firings, not to mention dumping some top-name talent. But that's the only way for a mature network to control costs. Sports costs more than ever, and in fact, sports is more popular than ever. ESPN reached 91.8 million unique viewers on its traditional cable channel in October. It also attracted more than 1 billion visits on its digital properties. And 9 million unique devices streamed Watch ESPN, which is up 39% from the same month 1 year earlier. Now for the bad news. ESPN has lost 7 million subscribers in North America in the past 2 years. dropping from 99 million to 92 million subscribers. In fact, that's what's happening for most Disney channels. ABC Family lost 5 million, and Disney lost 4 million. This is going to be something you hear a lot about in the next year or two. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, obviously, both for the positive push into digital, which is where viewership is happening a little bit more, and for the fall in subscribers. This is that Disney story we talked about with Star Wars, how like investors are saying, well, we don't care because Star Wars is going to make so much money. They're sort of, stock fell on the announcement that, they've lost 7 million subscribers over the past 2 years, because that's, like $5, $8 a month that they get, whatever that fee is that people pay to just to watch one, that one channel as part of their package, and the money goes back to Disney. That's, every month, that's 7 million people not making an extra $28 million a month, $280 million, it adds up very quickly. And wow, this is real cord cutting, isn't it? Now, cord cutting typically meant, you weren't going to pay any money. You were going to save money and just watch stuff online. Well, you're just moving your money from one side to the other. We've recognized that. But this is, again, part of that sea change in TV viewing habits. They've lost 7 million subscribers. That's a lot.
Yeah, I wonder if they can make it up internationally. When I was in Brazil, at night I would, just to kind of zone out a little bit, I'd turn on, soccer. There was a soccer game or match on 3 or 4 networks there almost every night.
I should hope so.
And then afterwards, they'd have their version of Sports Center. And really, what did they lead with after, kind of recapping the soccer match? Is American football. And it was really weird. They'd be talking another language, and all of a sudden you'd hear the word Tennessee Titans. And I was just like, why do you guys care about American football?
Well, did they show them on the air there?
I guess they must.
They must.
Yeah.
Right?
I mean, it just goes to show, they're trying to, and the NFL is trying to expand into the UK, and they're really making an international push. And, for television purposes, maybe it makes sense.
Well, I wonder if it's more ESPN trying to scratch the back of the NFL.
I don't know.
By putting it around the world and trying to get people more interested
ESPN,
in it, or whether
though.
There's that demand already for information.
It was not ESPN.
Oh, it was not ESPN,
no.
or whoever the network is. Was it a local?
Yeah, it was a local sports channel.
I wonder if your friend in Brazil who said he rate and reviewed the show, does he watch American football?
I don't know.
If they want to let us know, how do they reach us?
Dirt@showbizsandbox.com.
All right.
Now, we just talked about firings at ESPN. You know what? Let's talk about firings again, because after a tumultuous year, the Weinstein Company is firing 40 to 50 employees, leaving them with some 200 employees in all. After key execs left earlier this year, it promoted from within and convinced David Glasser to re-up at the boutique studio. Staffers were reportedly surprised by the bloodbath, but of course, there's no better short-term way to cut costs than, fire people. They're looking for success with 2 key films due out soon. Both are Oscar hopefuls, and both should be hits in their own way. Quentin Tarantino has The Hateful Eight due out amidst police chiefs around the U.S. calling for people to boycott his movies. And Cate Blanchett's Carol hopes to be an Oscar contender and slowly build on its solid limited opening. It's a great movie. Go see it. Big deal or big whoop?
I didn't like the movie as much as you, but it's certainly handsomely made and well acted by Cate Blanchett. But we said a few weeks ago when they re-upped Dave Glasser, they're in good shape. He wouldn't come back unless he believed that they were there long term. And now they're firing 50 people. What's going on?
I have no
idea. Are they getting
ready
to sell? Are they? What's happening?
I think, they're trying to raise money, probably, or sell the company. And one way to do
that. Why did Glasser come back?
Because they need management. When you're buying a company or when you're trying to raise money, investors look at management. And so they needed a manager. And he's one of the top managers in the business right now. So that's who you want on your creative team.
All right.
Michael, we didn't really talk about Paris because it happened right after our last show. So did the International Emmys. In fact, voting was closed before the Paris attacks. So it's all the sweeter that the French were big winners at the International Emmys. Hosted by Egyptian TV personality Bassem Youssef, the Emmys gave Best Drama to France's Spiral, a long-running legal drama, probably produced by Dick Wolf. They also won Best Miniseries for White Soldier, about French military in Vietnam, and Best Arts Program with The Man Who Saved the Louvre. I actually want to see that. That sounds interesting. Netherlands and Norway won top acting prizes. South Africa won Best Documentary for Miners Shot Down. And Brazil triumphed in the competitive telenovela category with a show called Empire. And no, not That Empire. And Best Comedy, they also won for Sweet Mother. Finally, the UK won for Best Reality Show with 50 Ways to Kill Your Mammy, which documents the thrill-seeking adventures of a man and his 70-year-old mother. Actually, I do want to see that. I'm not a big reality show fan, but I want to see one episode of that. Big deal or big whoop.
And I think Betty White just has her next franchise.
That's right.
Let's send Betty White around the world doing thrill-seeking adventures. It's a big deal. You know, it's a great way to keep track of the great television around the world and what we should be paying attention to. I don't know how important the Emmys are compared to some of the other big European awards, but I think they're catching up as far as prestige. And I got a list of shows I want to check out.
Gawker is reeling from controversy over this whole Big Deal or Big Whoop is filled with people getting fired.
Well, hopefully we won't be fired.
So Gawker, they've got their own controversy going on over both its reporting of the private lives of, let's face it, at best, modestly public figures. They promised to get kinder and gentler and smarter, but instead they're firing staffers and focusing on politics. Because with everything from the Drudge Report to Politico to Vox to your stomping grounds, Michael, the Huffington Post, what politics really needs is another online site chasing clickbait. The site, wrote Gawker's founder, Nick Denton, and this is a quote, will ride the circus of the 2016 campaign cycle, seizing the opportunity to reorient its editorial scope on political news, commentary, and satire. Kind of like what The Daily Show does? I don't know. The quote goes on to say, is there any doubt that the 2016 U.S. presidential election campaign, a contest between reality-defying fabulous and the last representatives of two exhausted political dynasties, will provide rich new opportunities for sensation and satire? Big deal or big whoop?
I think it's a big deal because it feels like the death of Gawker.
Well, the death of Gawker has been greatly exaggerated in the past numerous times.
Uh-huh. So they keep managing to rise phoenix-like from the ashes. People think nobody's going to care about Gawker anymore, but still it makes money.
Somehow. I mean, when you look at their traffic, it's unbelievable. Over 100 million unique visitors.
And do you think dumping entertainment, they're going to have a very broad definition, of course, of politics. They're going to include the media and stuff, you know, celebrities talking about, you know, I'm sure they'll make it as broad as possible. It's not going to be, you know, who's positioned on the federal banking system.
Right.
You know, and if they can dig up dirt, I guess, but you think they'll be able to pivot like this? I mean, that's a massive change, isn't it?
It is. And they're getting rid of Valley Wag, which covers Silicon Valley, and IO9, which was kind of like their sci-fi.
And that's going to save them money, I guess, right?
Yes. I mean, yes, that's the reality is that they're...
Are they they had to fire staffers and now they're trying to turn it into a positive? I said, well, we'll just focus on politics. That's what... We're not getting rid of our Silicon Valley coverage because we have to cut costs. We're doing it because we want to focus on politics.
Right, and I think they like let a certain number of staffers go and they hired almost two-thirds of that, not necessarily back, but they hired new people to do the politics stuff.
Yeah.
So it's like they were
they'll be hired at a lower cost and all that.
I'm sure that's true.
Yeah.
CBS has made its choice. The show that will debut after the Super Bowl will be their new late night standard bearer, The Late Show with Stephen Colbert. And it couldn't come at a more important time. Late night battles take place over months and years, not weeks. Nonetheless, Colbert has been taking it on the chin lately. Oh, I get it, because Jay Leno, is that what you're trying to... Anyway, Jimmy Fallon has been beating it soundly from the start. And now Jimmy Kimmel has been edging past Colbert in both the key demos of 18 to 49 and getting closer in total viewers. In fact, thanks to his big lead-in, Seth Meyers is breathing down the neck of Colbert and Kimmel as well. So Colbert is rooting for a close Super Bowl game and hoping the millions of viewers who tune in like what they see. And he's not talking about the Super Bowl game. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal, right? The show needs it. It's a new show. It probably hasn't found its foot yet creatively. And this is another big chance to reintroduce itself to America. We'll have to see how it does. I'm sure it'll get a big audience. It'll give them a short-term boost, just like the Super Bowl or the Olympics often do. And Super Bowl has not been a great platform to launch shows. It happens, but it's not like a guarantee, but at least it lets people see your show. And in this case, it reminds them, oh yeah, it's a late night show.
VHS wins.
Yay!
Yes, in a triumphant victory for the VHS format, Sony has announced it will stop producing Betamax tapes some 40 years after introducing them.
What?
This means VHS has the field all to itself, along with Laserdiscs, DivX, DVD, Blu-ray, and digital downloads. Big deal or big whoop?
Wow. It's a big whoop, of course. I guess the Betamax machines stopped being made in 2002, but who knew they were still making VHS tapes? Not me.
I mean,
who knew they were still making Betamax tapes? Not me.
You know, they also said in a separate announcement that they would no longer produce the Sony Walkman for cassettes. In recent years, the Oxford Dictionary has named various trendy things the word of the year. And these are words such as selfie and vape. This year, the word of the year isn't even a word. It's an emoji. Specifically, it's an emoji of a face smiling and with tears flowing, dubbed, quote, face with tears of joy, end quote. The spread of visual pictographs to get across very specific and complex emotions and ideas is a trend the Oxford Dictionary felt needed to be acknowledged as a form of communication. This angered everybody from Egypt who said, what the heck do you think hieroglyphics were those thousands of years ago? Competing for next year, the noncommittal shrug and the grunt of disapproval. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big whoop, of course, in the scheme of things. Of course, these words are trendy because they're being added new to the dictionary. So by definition, they've got to be trendy. But emoji, I think, is a pretty significant step forward to recognize, you know, visual representation as being part of the modern iconography and how people communicate. So I really think it is significant. And I don't think it's a thing that they'll look back on in 10 years and go, well, that was dumb. Because, you know, you get them all the time. They seem to be sticking around, you know, so I think it makes sense.
I'm going to make a prediction for next year's word of the year.
Okay.
It will be another emoji. It will be poop with smiley face.
I thought you were going to say something about virtual reality. Keep going.
No, not at all. It's the greatest launch of TV shows in history. No single new show launched by the major networks has been canceled yet. It's a triumph of unprecedented success. Or actually, it's just a reflection that ratings take a lot longer to figure out, as we'll be discussing momentarily. DVRs have made reruns, especially for dramas, simply unacceptable filler, and that a poorly performing show is better than a TV signal test pattern. Of course, it can't last forever, and numerous shows have seen their episode order trimmed, script orders trimmed, and so on. That's kind of like the new canceled. So the writing is obviously on the wall for flops like Wicked City. Still, is its newfound patience a big deal or big whoop? Wait a second. Hold on. They canceled Wicked City after just 3 episodes. Big deal or big whoop?
It's a big deal. I think it is. I mean, there were editorials, I think, in Hollywood Reporter or Variety, I forget which, chiding them. Oh, come on. Admit the show is dead. Why haven't you canceled it? It's like, well, they've got nothing else to put up there. And then they said, well, they should have plenty of programming, cheap programming available to fill in the slots. It's like, well, come on. It's like, that's awfully hard to do and expensive. It's not easy to have an endless supply of TV to fill up prime time.
You know, so, if we had the staff of a Daily Show, okay, you know what I would do right now? I would actually read from an editorial from like 8 years ago that both of those publications had. That
saying, how dare you cancel shows too quickly?
Correct.
Exactly. But, you know, they're being more patient, or they're just admitting we've got nothing better to put in its place. Whatever. It's good that they take their time. And frankly, you don't know what shows are going to be picked live plus 7 or live plus 30. They say, well, that's a joke, but you know what? It isn't always. You know, the things change. And as far as TV, I'm liking My Crazy Ex-Girlfriend. That's the one new show of the fall I've added to my list. It's not a perfect show by any stretch of the imagination, but it's fresh, it's different, it's awkward. The female lead is hilarious, and she's self-loathing, and it's just a funny, it's a musical comedy in prime time. That already shows how, you know, unusual it is. So
got 5 more episodes,
and they bumped up the episode order. It's not doing great in the ratings, but I think it'll definitely be back for a second season. And I think it's just a real triumph for Rachel Bloom, who's the co-creator and star of the show. And beyond that, check out Amazon, their pilots. They have a pilot called Patriot, which I think is really, really good. It's well worth watching and then voting for, so that maybe they'll turn that into a series.
Well, that brings us to actually the biggest news of the week, according to, well, every media outlet on earth, it seems like, when it comes to covering entertainment. All they could talk about was Adele this, Adele that, Adele this. You know, Adele's new album, 25, it's out now. And you can hear her songs on the radio, in fact. You can play the videos from that album online. You can buy a digital download or an honest-to-goodness CD, which about 51% of those who purchased her album did. What you really can't do is stream it. You can't stream it on Spotify or Apple or anywhere else. In unrelated news, the album sold more than 3.38 million copies in its first week, beating the previous record set by NSYNC with 2.4 million copies sold in the first week way back in 2000. Is this a big deal or a big whoop?
Well, it's a big deal, right? There's no way to say it. I'm interested by the streaming, why they kept it a secret. Like, the New York Times broke the story that Adele was not going to have her album available for streaming. Did they think people would be angered or offended? Oh, what do you mean I can't? I mean, you'd think they'd want them to know, hey, pre-order the album, pre-order the CD, or pre-order it online because you're not going to be able to stream it. You think they'd want people to know that.
Well, I wonder if the record company just assumed people would know it because...
Why? Almost every album is available for streaming.
Well, yes, but Adele, historically, and...
Well, she's only got three albums. There's no historical track record. And the last album came out 5 years ago. So,
right.
No, they didn't assume people knew. They did not want people... They kept it secret, and the Times had to break the story. It was a choice that they specifically made. It wasn't an accident that people didn't know. It was a conscious decision of theirs, and I wonder why.
Well, here's the thing. When I read that story, I thought, well, of course she's not. She pulled 21 from Spotify. She pulled 19 from Spotify.
No. Why did they not choose to let people know, hey, you want to hear the album? You got to buy it.
I have
We're
no
not
idea.
Talking about what
look,
she didn't. We
I
know.
Don't know why. I don't know why the record company didn't do that. Maybe it was an oversight.
It was a choice. It was a specific choice. The Times had to break the story.
Well, I will tell you, any big artist like Taylor Swift, like an Adele.
Well, Taylor Swift's available on Apple.
Now.
Her new album was available day and date on Apple.
Yes, but that was a
separate issue. She was happy to have it available on Apple. But I don't understand why a big artist would allow their new album to be streaming on the opening day. Why not wait 3 months?
And by the way, you can stream the song Hello on Spotify. But just that one song.
No, you can play it on Vimeo. You can hear it, you know, a million different ways.
Yes.
Yes, that's true. We know that.
Yeah. Is that the story here? I mean,
I thought it was interesting that they kept a secret. It's a huge number. There's no way to, it may be the record all time. We don't know because Nielsen SoundScan numbers only go back to 1991. Did the Beatles sell more than 3 million copies in opening week someday, 30, 40, maybe. I don't know. We know it's a record and we know it's a different era, right? I mean, what are the numbers?
Well, I'd like to say that is what this story to me really highlights is that every once in a while you get a story like this that kind of highlights the industry in its present form. It's like a slice, of time for this industry because 25, Adele's album, was 67.1% of total sales of the top 200 albums in the United States. We don't have numbers for international, otherwise we'd add them. It was 57.2% of the top 1,000 albums sold. That's
right, almost
ridiculous.
If anybody bought an album last week, it was Adele's. Like when the NSYNC album came out and set the record of 2.4 million copies in the modern era, that was a year where 700 million albums were sold. Last year, just 250 million albums were sold, both physical and digital. So, I mean, it's like 60% smaller market, and yet she still set this record. That shows how dominating it is. And of course, they come up with some dumb stuff. Nielsen says the average Adele fan is a college-educated woman aged 25 to 44 who watches Family Guy on TV and likes to shop at Target, Victoria's Secret, and Bath & Body Works. What
right.
is that supposed to help anyone about?
Well, I mean, a part of what everybody's saying is, look, it's not that streaming, it has nothing to do with streaming, okay? Adele's was...
Well, it does. I'm sure they sold more copies because you couldn't stream it.
Well, look, this is a song...
Of course it did.
She has a broad audience. My 9-year-old loves this song.
She's Michael Jackson. She's the biggest star in the world right now. Absolutely.
Right. In fact, the first week of sales of 25 actually upped the sales of 21 and 19. They came in number 8 and number 15, respectively.
Sure, that happens a lot. But why would Bruce Springsteen, not that he's a big... huge bestseller, but why would he make his new album available streaming? If he could have the choice and say, I'm going to wait 3 months, why wouldn't he? Why would he allow people to play it for free when he could get them to pay for it?
Well, somebody like him shouldn't, because the reality is...
You gain nothing.
Yeah, Spotify needs Bruce Springsteen and Adele more than those two artists need Spotify.
Ed Sheeran needed Spotify when he was not known.
Correct.
And he's been grateful, and he talks about how great they are and how they've made his worldwide audience. He's got, hundreds of millions of listens to all these different songs, and he's now playing arenas and making lots of money. He's jumped very quickly to a big touring act. I'm a little surprised, but hey, more power to him. His next album, I think probably to keep goodwill, he probably will make available day and date streaming, but he shouldn't, not financially. I think his fans would be happy to pay for the album. Why make it available? Say, hey, in 3 months you can stream it.
Well, I've actually
hear it now,
seen...
buy it.
I've seen some of Ed Sheeran's, not to get off on an Ed Sheeran kick here, but there's some, fan shot videos on YouTube of some of his shows. He is one heck of a performer live. I didn't know Ed Sheeran from a hole in the wall. I watched some of his live performances.
He's done well on the Grammys. He's a good live performer. I don't really like his music. It's okay, but I'm not a big fan of the albums as such. But, you know, he's working it hard.
Yeah, well, you know, here's the reality. We mentioned Spotify, right? Notice we're not mentioning Ardio. And that's not just because this past week, Pandora purchased Ardio, right?
And are probably shutting it down, right?
Well, they are shutting it down. They, you know, as it was, I think they owed like $200 million, where they were losing $2 million a month. They had only 150,000 subscribers. And that's an estimate as the most number of, that is the highest subscriber count they could have had. And so they basically filed for bankruptcy, sold all of their intellectual property to Pandora for $75 million, and Ardio, Spotify's big competitor here in the U.S., they're out. They're right. no longer...
So Pandora's not making money, so they bought a company that's not making money because they think they can make more money that way.
Well, wait a second. Here's what Pandora's doing, okay? Right now, they have... And this is the reason Pandora has Adele, because they are internet radio. They are non-interactive.
Just like every terrestrial radio station in the country, they can play songs from Adele's new album. They can't put up the whole album all at once and let you play it on demand, but
correct,
they can play individual tracks just like every other radio station in the country.
Using a compulsory license. Right. However, that business model may not work out if royalty rates for the compulsory licenses go up, as many predict they will, because it's the only way for record companies to make money.
Well, Pandora is still not a profitable business, is it?
No. That said, they're looking at, okay, well, how do we get into the on-demand business? We can buy our way in. So they bought Ardio.
And Ardio is not like radio because you can do it on demand.
That's right.
Strangely enough. Well, there's one other cool thing about Adele, and that is her tour.
This is absolutely fascinating. And I know, Michael, you know, when we discuss, do we talk about Adele and this news? And you kind of said, well, gee, everybody's covering it. What's the point? But all of the offshoots of it, the streaming information, the numbers and the slice of the industry that it gives us. And now, as you say, Michael, she is going with indie promoters on her tour of the U.S. rather than Live Nation or AEG. And what makes that a big deal is if you're her booking agent or her manager or her promoter, okay, you would go to Live Nation or AEG. You could book the whole tour probably in less than a week. And you could do it through two or three, maybe four deals, okay? Now what she's doing is she's going city by city, promoter to promoter, and booking her tour in venues with individual independent promoters. So here in LA, it'll probably be Niederlander, who runs the Greek Theater. It'll probably be somebody in New York, Michael, that runs the Beacon Theater, okay?
Or she's not going to play the Beacon.
Okay, yeah.
No, she's going to play Madison Square Garden. She's not playing the Beacon.
Yeah, you're right.
Beacon's tiny. Yes, this is cool. You like to have competition. They'll obviously make more money. It's more work going in.
It's a heck of a lot more work. I mean,
but clearly the cost of that extra work will be more than compensated for by having people actually, you know, compete for the contract and compete for the right to have her play their venue. And they'll make more money down the road. The question is, will she use this so that she can keep ticket prices lower, not have massive fees tacked onto the ticket, and do something very simple, like say you have to bring your ID to the venue. You're going to get in. You need your ID. And that will take care of the incredible scamming and what do you call it?
The secondary markets.
Yeah. What's it called? Scalping. Scalping. You can easily eliminate scalping or make it very, very difficult. Just insist that they have to have their contract with them, their photo ID or their credit card. There, it's problem solved.
Well,
so
like, okay.
If she uses this because she wants to do that, great. If she does this because she wants to keep prices lower, even though she knows she could charge $250, but she wants to reach more young people and let everybody go. And, you know, she hasn't really toured yet substantially in the U.S. at all, right? I mean, she had her vocal issues and...
No,
you know,
she's toured in the U.S.,
She's toured, but not like to the level that she could have or would have.
No, that is true. But she basically exhausted herself on the 21 tour.
Right,
and
so she's got to pace herself, and she wants to build a long-term, I mean, not that she doesn't have a long-term career already, but, you know, do a great show and not have ticket prices be $250 for everybody, even in the back seats. Great.
My prediction, Coachella.
Okay, sure, why not?
Although, that's an AEG show, so maybe not.
Well, it's not that you won't work with AEG on individual venues, right?
Yeah, exactly. It's that, right. But and
she hasn't said they're evil. She just wants people to compete rather than do it all lock, stock, and barrel with one place. She wants each market to pay attention, to focus on her, to be committed to making the show right and get a better rate.
Well, and AEG and Live Nation did this roll up throughout the 90s of all these market promoters. So they, you know, they went market to market, scooping up all the independent promoters and turning them into one giant promoter and buying up all of the venues and contracting with all the venues so that you really couldn't go anywhere else. And I think it's interesting that it's come full circle now to the hottest act going today is saying, actually, we're going to go the other way because it's better for us if we do. It's more work, but in the long run, it's better for us. We'll get better promotion for our tour in each city if that were the case, and we'll make more money doing that.
And the thing to watch long term is ticket prices and how they deal with scalping, because you can easily deal with scalping, or at least make it far more difficult.
Yeah, that said, you know, there is a place for the secondary market. As a for instance, I had tickets to see Leon Bridges. I had to go out of town to Brazil and couldn't use them, couldn't find anybody I knew that could purchase them. I put them on StubHub for exactly, I think, $3 or $4 more than face value, just so that somebody could have them and I could get reimbursed for the face value of the tickets. They sold in less than 4.5 minutes.
Right. Maybe to someone who then resold them higher. But yeah, we're not talking about that. That's not the issue that we're trying to tackle. But if it eliminates that as well, tough. You know, the big problem is the fact that when you try to go buy tickets to a show, they're all gone immediately and you have to pay a huge markup. And of course, they make the ticket prices bigger and bigger, bigger every step of the way. Only a few acts like Garth Brooks and a couple others are committed and focused on making sure ticket prices are reasonable and build that long-term audience for themselves and for music going in general. And hopefully Adele will be one of them too.
Well, think about it this way. In 1999, I saw Bruce Springsteen. It cost $95.
Okay.
Yeah.
How much? $95. That's a lot of
money. It was the first time he was with the E Street Band in, I think, more than a decade.
Right.
Now when you see him, it's like $98 or something like that. He hasn't raised the ticket prices.
Right.
So
he's lowered them, really.
Yeah. I kind of respect that, frankly.
Well, sure. Absolutely. But this is all sort of pretty inside baseball, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. I guess it would be. Yeah. Were you trying to move us along into inside baseball where we analyze some of the headlines that have the entertainment industry buzzing, where we explain what they mean for the business and, more importantly, how they affect our listeners?
Maybe I was.
Oh, okay. Well, I know we've been talking about this, it seems like every week, but following in the wake of key cable channels like AMC and USA, the Fox TV network announced they would stop reporting their overnights, which are same-day ratings snapshot. In an email, they explained, quote, "The connections between viewers and our shows today are more complex and, in many ways, deeper than ever, but they no longer only happen overnight. So why do we, as an industry, wake up every morning and talk about those live plus same day numbers? This has to stop," end quote. And now, for Fox, it actually has. Exceptions will be made for sports and live events where time shifting is not necessarily a significant issue. And when I saw this news story, Michael, I had landed in Los Angeles, turned on my phone, saw this news story in my email from the Hollywood Reporter. I immediately thought, oh, wow, Michael must be jumping over the moon. The very next thing on my iPhone to pop up was a notice from Raul Buril, one of our listeners, who posted to our Facebook page saying, "Michael must be over the moon about this."
Smoking a cigar.
Yeah, and I was like, oh my goodness, I was thinking the same exact thing. That all happened within the space of about 90 seconds.
Well, there's a reason Fox did this, right? There's a reason AMC and, you know, why HBO never reports overnight, you know, numbers
If their overnight numbers were good, they'd report them. They're not good.
Well, it's not that they're not good. AMC has great overnight numbers for The Walking Dead and stuff, but it's just they have much better numbers. And they just said, let's not get in that game. What's stupid? Why underplay our big audience? So they have great overnights. I mean, The Walking Dead is lower now than it was 2 or 3 years ago. It's like 12 million instead of 15 million. That's just because the audience is live plus 3 and live plus 7. It's not because they don't have the audience. And so why tout lower numbers when, in fact, your numbers are just as good or better than ever? But why was it Fox? Why was Fox the first network to do it? Cynical reason? Because Fox does a lot better in this time shifting than the other networks. That's where they look strongest. They look, you know, CBS looks great in the overnights, while Fox looks a lot better if you look at live plus 7.
Conspiracy!
Well, not conspiracy, but it's like that's why they were the first one to make this step. But I do think the others would be smart to follow in their wake, don't you?
Yes, and I think I've been trying to book a guest to come in and talk about this whole Nielsen ratings thing. I've been following the stories that are being written about it and then looking for a good reporter to come in and talk to us about this. I think this is going to continue to be a story throughout 2016, if not 2017. But let's face it, cable cutting is happening. Cable shaving is happening. That's where people say, well,
lower their rates. Yeah.
Yeah. Do I really need every single channel? I never really watch Desportes. I don't even speak Spanish. Maybe I should get that off my network or off my cable bill. I think, they have to figure out a new way to measure the audience. And they are, and to Nielsen's credit, a day late and a dollar short, they're coming up with some new ways to do that, which should be out by the end of the year, actually.
Right. Well, you look at Fox, they're live plus seven. They're the only network that's on par with last year. The other networks are down. Fox, if you look at live plus seven, is holding steady from last year overall. They're up 14% in multi-platform audience. All right. So, they've got a good story to tell. Within a 7-day period, more than one third of the audience on television watches after the same day window. So a third of your 18 to 49 audience is tuning in after the overnights. They don't watch it overnight. They watch it 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 days later. Over 30 days, 7 of Fox's series double or more than double their same day audience across all platforms. And if you include multi-platforms, which is more than just DVRs and pay-per-view or pay on demand, then they're up, even more. So you look at all that and you say, well, duh, why are they ignoring their big audience? And of course, this is why they're waking up and they're saying, that big shift in time viewing and how people watch TV, it's now really taken hold. I mean, it's just dramatic. But bizarrely, it is not as bad for advertising as you would think. People watch DVRs, but they don't always fast forward through the commercials. Sometimes they watch video on demand. Those commercials are embedded. Or they watch on Hulu. Commercials are embedded unless you pay for them to be off of there. So it's not the same commercials being paid for, but they are reaching an audience and they can monetize that.
Why would you fast forward through the commercials? That's the only time to check your email, check Twitter, check Facebook.
That's what I don't understand.
Okay.
Yeah. So, Hulu is the most popular site for catching up on network show reruns. So if you don't catch on the network, you often know, I'll go check out Hulu if that's your site. But, figuring out how to get people to figure out where TV shows are. Is it on your DVR? Is it on demand? Is it on Hulu? Is it Netflix? Is it Amazon? It's tricky. And I think that's what the set-top box, what all those people are trying to figure out, isn't it? That's what Apple and everybody else wants to crack. If they can make that easy and people don't have to worry and figure out, well, which multi-platform site can I actually even find it on? And is it available for me or do I want to pay for it? That's sort of the next trick, isn't it?
That's what Roku and as you mentioned, Apple TV, they're all trying to make it, hey, I want to watch, I think you in the show notes here, you've mentioned Archer. Okay.
Right.
Where
and
is
I
it?
I didn't know where it was. Right. Yeah. So we were like, we looked on for it. It wasn't on our DVR. We looked on it on Amazon. We found it on VOD. We're like, all right, we'll watch it on VOD. It means we got to watch ads, but we'll do it. So, it took us 2 minutes to figure it out. And we did. But, solving that problem of, hey, people are watching your television, but they're not watching it at 8:30 p.m. on a Tuesday. They're not watching it necessarily on their DVR and finding out who they are, getting the show to them. And then tracking their eyeballs and getting money for it, that's the big trick.
Well, we're trying to get money for our eyeballs. Not ours, yours and mine, Michael. But maybe it's earballs that we're trying to get money for.
That's right. One last thing was that USA Today, I think, ended their weekly chart of primetime television. For 20-plus years, however long USA Today has been around, I cut out their weekly chart in the entertainment section where they list all of primetime television and every show and their ratings. It's just the overnights now. So it's horribly outdated. And I email them. I'm like, change this. You should do this. You should do that. You should do the other thing. But I think they've gotten rid of it entirely because what's the point? Why a week later are they printing the overnight numbers? They're out of date. They're stupid.
Technology always outpaces legislation and media coverage.
True.
That's why we talked about VR before everybody else. I'm kidding, of course. Hey, listen, again, thanks to everybody for your patience over the last 2 weeks. We'll have another show next week. But in the meantime, you can write to us. dirt@showbizsandbox.com is our email address. That's dirt@showbizsandbox.com. You can call and leave us a voicemail at 888-567-SAND. That's 888-567-7263. Again, please do subscribe to the show in iTunes, the Microsoft Marketplace, Stitcher, wherever they give podcasts away. You can find all of that information on our website, showbizsandbox.com. That's where you'll find links to all of the stories we've discussed on today's episode, as well as ways to follow us on Twitter, where our handle is @showbizsandbox, or like us on Facebook, where if you search for Showbiz Sandbox, our page should come up. The music that you hear at the beginning and end of each show is by the popular indie rock group MGMT. We have a page, a webpage, showbizsandbox.com. They have a webpage, a website, whoismgmt.com. Michael Giltz has a website, and every week it's something new and exciting. What is it this week, Michael?
This week it's jesuiparisian.com.
I don't speak Swahili, so... I'm kidding, of course. That means...
But actually, my personal website, michaelgiltz.com, was down for a few months. I had to switch to a new host site, had to reload all the documents. I finished that over Thanksgiving, so it's back up, cleaned up, updated, so that's good to know.
And that's where all of your work covering the entertainment industry for various outlets, that's where it all kind of matriculates.
Ends up. That's where, yeah, if you want to aggregates. Find Michael Giltz, you don't have to know, where do I go? Where do I look? It's all there.
No, not on Apple TV. You go to michaelgiltz.com or bookfilter.com. Some of my work can be found on celluloidjunkie.com. Until next week, play nice.